Okay, so now let's talk about connective tissue. There's three basic elements here. Now remember that when we talked about epithelium, we talked about the cells being the tissue. Now we're going to talk about connective tissue, and that's not the case. The cells are not the tissue in connective tissue. The cells make stuff that will become the connective tissue. So it's like the cells are the manufacturing plant of or for the connective tissue. So that substance that the connective tissue cells make is called ground substance. So it's like ground substance. So if we consider, like, for instance, cartilage. Now, cartilage is going to be stuff that's going to be between our joints. Like, let's say the meniscus that's in our knees. We have this cartilage that's between our knees, so that when we run or jump, we have this rubber substance that's going to allow for sort of a shock absorbing. Now, that rubbery substance is not going to be the cells. That rubbery substance is going to be the matrix, or the ground substance. Ground substance and matrix are going to be the same. So this ground substance, or this matrix, is going to be what's going to be created by the cells. And that's going to be our cartilage. So that stuff that the cells make is a rubbery kind of substance. That rubbery kind of substance then is going to be what will allow for that joint to work properly. So in connective tissue, the cells are not the major thing. It's what the cells make, and that's going to be ground substance, also called matrix. Now within the matrix, we can have fibers. And there are going to be a variety of fibers. We can either have collagen fibers, elastic fibers, or reticular fibers. Now the thickest fiber is going to be the collagen. Picture it having two big L's, so it's going to be thick. On the other end of the spectrum is going to be the one guy that's got one L, and his name is elastic. So he's going to be the thinnest. And in between, we're going to have reticular fibers, which are going to be medium-sized fibers. Now, remember that connective tissue, as we already said, with a paper cut, you cut through the epithelium, it's going to hurt like hell, but you're not going to get any blood. If you cut yourself too much, though, with a paper cut, it will start to bleed. Now you know you're into the connective tissue. Connective tissue is highly vascular. But with every rule, there's also an exception. The exception to this rule is that cartilage is not vascular. Now, why would you make a tissue that doesn't have blood supply? Well, remember, your epithelium doesn't have blood supply. So how does it get its nutrients? Through diffusion. So how do you suppose the cartilage gets its nutrients? Gets it through diffusion as well. Now, why don't you want it to have a high vascularity? Why don't you want it to have a lot of blood vessels? The reason is because of that. What we just said, we're talking about cartilage being a shock absorber. So if you put lots of pressure on it, you're going to break blood vessels if they're there. So don't put blood vessels in there. So make sure that it can do its job of absorbing shock and not break blood vessels, because your knees would constantly be bleeding, for instance. That wouldn't be good. So that's why then most people that have injuries to a joint, they'll be sent for exercise. Exercise is going to be very beneficial in trying to get vascularity, to get nutrients to the cartilage. Because the cartilage can't get nutrients through the blood system, but it can get it through diffusion. So the more we exercise that joint, the more we're going to be seeing that we're going to get more nutrients into the cartilage, and it should be able to heal itself better. Now, when we talked about the epithelium, we said that we have a first name, a middle name, and a last name. But in cartilage or in connective tissue, we don't have a first and last name. We just have one word that we describe connective tissue by. That one word, though, has a prefix and a suffix. It has a beginning part to that word and an ending part to that word. The first part of the word is always going to be what the cell is. The last part of the word is always going to be what the cell age is. Is the cell old, or is the cell a new cell? Usually if it's a new cell, it's a cell that's producing whatever the first part of the word is. If it's an older cell, it's going to be a cell that's going to be maintaining whatever the first part of the word is. So let's look at one cell. a connective tissue cell called a fibrocyte. Fibro means fiber. So this is going to be a cell that's going to have created a fiber. So a fibrocyte is an older cell. So it's going to be a cell that is maintaining a fiber. A fibroblast would be a cell that has created a fiber because it's a younger cell. An osteo means bone. An osteoblast would be a cell that's going to build up bone, make bone. Whereas an osteocyte is going to be a cell that's going to maintain the bone because it's an older cell. So an osteoblast is going to be the builder. The osteocyte is going to be the maintainer. We can look at an erythroblast. Erythroblast is going. Erythro means red blood cell or red blood. So we're going to have, or red actually was what it means. So we have red, so erythro, and then we have blast. So an erythroblast would be a young blood cell. Whereas we have an erythrocyte, which would be an older blood cell. We have a chondroblast, which would be a cell that's going to be making cartilage. We have a chondrocyte, which is going to be a cell that's going to be maintaining that cartilage. We remember this because if a kid has a good time, he usually doesn't have a good time, he usually has a blast. So he's going to be young. Whereas if we get a little bit older, we start to have to have glasses, so we may need to have a help with our sight. So a sight tells us an older cell, blast tells us it's a younger cell. Now some types of connective tissue are going to be containing gel-like ground substances between the cells, as we said. So we can have, for instance, loose connective tissue, we can have dense connective tissue, we can have cartilage, and finally we can have bone and blood. When you go, bone and blood are connective tissues? Well, think about it. Bone connects everything, and also blood connects everything. So when we look at these different types, we'll see that we're going to either have loose and dense as a big category, and then we get into the cartilage, bone, and blood. Let's look at areolar tissue. It's going to be our loose tissue. With areolar tissue, we're going to be seeing a loose arrangement of collagen and elastic fibers. It's going to be underlining blood vessels and nerves, even the fascia between muscles. We're going to have two types of fibers here. Typically, we have collagen, which are going to be the thicker fibers, and the dark fibers are going to be elastic fibers. Anytime you see areolar tissue, individuals always look at it and go, oh, look at those lines going across. What's that? That's going to be your elastic fibers, thin. But in the background, if you look, you'll see that there's going to be more pink, thicker fibers. Those are going to be your collagen fibers. When we look at your reticular tissue, remember that's going to be our medium-sized fiber. So we're going to have those in reticular tissue. Reticular tissue looks very similar to a vineyard, where you have the reticular fibers being very similar to the vines, and you have the grapes coming off of those fibers, as of course those cells that have made those fibers. So when you see reticular tissue in the lab, you'll see how it looks just like a vineyard. Now adipose tissue is going to be where we have large, empty-looking cells with thin margins, and the nucleus is going to be pushed against that margin. So usually the nucleus is going to be on the outside, not on the inside, or we typically think of the nucleus being in the middle of the cell. Not so in adipose tissue. Adipose tissue is important for storage of energy, insulation, also cushioning. We'll find this in the breast, find this in some of us more than others. We also have a dense regular connective tissue as opposed to the loose. The dense is going to be indeed denser. And if you have collagen fibers that are going to be parallel, we're going to be considering these guys to be regular. So a dense tissue is going to be regular. Now, the best example of this is going to be tendons and ligaments. Now, ligaments are going to be connective tissue that's going to be connecting bone to bone. A tendon will be a connective tissue that will be connecting muscle to bone. So that's the distinction between the two. Now we can have a dense tissue that's irregular. If we want our tissue to withstand stress applied in different directions, we want to have irregular kind of arrangements of fibers. If we want our tissue to not withstand stresses in different directions, such as having a ligament to keep your joints together, you don't really want them to vary. So you want, of course, dense, regular connective tissue. But if you're looking at, like, for instance, underneath your skin or in any kind of capsule where it needs to move back and forth, you want to use dense, irregular connective tissue. Now we get into cartilage, and cartilage is going to be where we have the chondroblasts, as we said, that are going to be making the matrix, and then they're, once surrounded, they're going to be called the chondrocytes. They're going to be maintaining the matrix. So the chondroblasts make, and the chondrocytes will maintain. Remember, there's going to be no blood vessels here. Some types are going to be hyaline, which won't have any fibers in it. Fibrocartilage, which will, and elastic cartilage, which will, of course, have elastic fibers in it. When we look at hyaline cartilage, we see it's going to be at the end of bone, and also in a variety of other places as well. Now, our elastic cartilage is going to be where we have the hyaline cartilage with elastic fibers in it. So it provides flexibility and also is allowed to bounce back. So if you take your ear, for instance, and unfold it, you'll see you can flatten it out, but then it goes right back to its original position. Fibrocartilage is very similar to elastic cartilage. However, now we have collagen fibers within it. It's going to be a stronger cartilage. It's going to have the capabilities of being shock absorbing, but also it's going to have the strength because it has the collagen fibers there. So we would want to put these, for instance, between two vertebrae. So we would make intervertebral discs out of fibrocartilage. And also the meniscus that I talked about within the knee. Also the pubic symphysis, which is right by the pubic bones where they come together. Now let's talk about bone. Bone, as we all know, is going to be hard. So we have hard bone. But what we don't really think about that much is really soft bone. We have hard bone on the outside and soft bone on the inside. This hard bone is called compact bone. The soft bone on the inside is called spongy bone. Now, spongy bone is also like marrow. So if you give a dog a bone, he will enjoy getting into the marrow. Because once he gets into the marrow, that's really what tastes the best. Why is that? Because it's going to have a lot of blood supply to it. It also has a little fat in there, so you get a lot of flavor. So why does spongy bone have so many blood vessels? Well, it's because it's spongy. Picture a kitchen sponge with a bunch of holes in it. You could put vessels through there, no problem. But we have a problem with compact bone, because it is so compact that it's difficult for us to get blood vessels through it. Therefore, we need a system to get blood to compact bone. We don't need a system to get blood to spongy bone or to the marrow. But we do need a system to get it to compact bone. This system is called a haversian system. And it uses, first of all, a central canal called the haversian canal. Then from that central canal, we have coming out little spider-like fingers or legs. These are going to be called the canaliculi. These canaliculi then will attach to the lacuna where the osteocyte sits. So a lacuna is like a bathtub or a crib where the osteocyte will sit. Now, what I've just described to you is an osteon. An osteon is the functional unit of compact bone. An osteon contains all those things that I just mentioned. The central canal, the canaliculi, the lacuna, and the osteocyte. Now, oftentimes we really can't see a lacuna inside of compact bone, but we can see one if we look at cartilage. Cartilage often will show a lacuna around the chondrocytes. Now, when we look at the osteocyte, we'll see that if we look at the osteon, we'll see that osteocytes are going to be going around in concentric circles around the central canal. So these osteocytes that are going around in concentric circles have space of matrix between them. The space of matrix between them is going to be called a lamella. So lamella is going to be the area of matrix between the circles, if you will, concentric circles that the osteocytes are going to be making. So that's going to be our compact bone. Another connective tissue is called blood. Now blood's going to be our other connective tissue that's going to be containing formed elements. Blood has formed elements within a watery matrix. So just like any other connective tissue, it has a matrix, but the matrix is going to be the water or plasma. The formed elements are going to be the cells within that matrix or within that water. Just like we have cartilage that has the chondrocytes within the matrix of cartilage, so too we have cells that we call formed elements that are going to be within the matrix of the plasma. So we call this whole collection blood. So what we have in blood is the plasma, then we have the formed elements of the RBCs, the WBCs, and the platelets. Our RBCs are called red blood cells, our WBCs are called white blood cells, and our platelets are going to be just called platelets. The RBCs are responsible for carrying oxygen. The WBCs, or white blood cells, are responsible for our immune system. And also the platelets are going to be responsible for blood clotting. So remember that blood is going to be produced from bone. Now let's look at our nerve cell. Our nerve cell is going to be, let's look at a nerve tissue. Nerve tissue is going to be containing two major cells. The first cell is going to be called a neuron. The next cell is going to be called a neuroglia. A neuroglia contains many, many cells, but let's just say it's just going to be a whole umbrella, and we'll talk about the cells underneath it. But basically, neuroglia is going to be like a connective tissue, if you will, of the nerve tissue. But the real cell is going to be the neuron. The neuron looks a little bit like an aardvark. That's the major cell of the nervous system, your neuron. To hold the neurons in place inside your brain, inside your spinal cord, you're going to have these astrocytes. These astrocytes are going to be gluing the nerves in your nervous system. So glia means glue. So you're going to have this glue to keep your nerves right in their proper position. So your nerves, as I've said, your neuron is going to look very similar to an aardvark. And an aardvark is an anteater. Not all anteaters are aardvarks, but aardvarks are anteaters. They have this real long nose, they have ears, and they have eyes. So it's a very good analogy to look at the dendrites as the ears. We have the eye being the nucleus. We have the axon being the nose of our aardvark. So neurons have cell bodies with a nucleus. They have axons, which are the ears. They also have a nose, which are the dendrites. Sorry, the nose, which is the axon. We have a number of neuroglia, as I mentioned. One example would be an astrocytoma. Astrocytomas are going to be astrocytes, and if they have cancer within them, we would call them an astrocytoma. So it would be the site of some inoperable brain tumors, would be in the neuroglia. If you had a tumor of your nerve, we would call it a neuroma. And that could be benign as well as malignant, but usually they're benign. Now, let's look at three muscle tissues. We have skeletal, cardiac, and smooth. Remember when we talked about looking histologically at muscle. We want to see it in a longitudinal section so that we can discern whether or not it's skeletal, cardiac, or smooth. So let's go over the differences between the two, but between the three. First of all, have skeletal and cardiac. These two are going to be characterized histologically by having striations. Striations are stripes. If we have no stripes, then it's easy to see what kind of tissue it is. It's going to be smooth. Because smooth, by definition, has no striations, has no stripes. So histologically, we can tell what the tissue is just by seeing whether or not it has stripes or not. But let's say that it does have stripes. Now we're left with it's either skeletal or cardiac. But how do we know? How can we differentiate from there? Well, one way we can know is think about the way that skeletal tissue is. Skeletal tissue is going to be holding up our skeleton. So what we're going to do with skeletal tissue is we're going to have it be very, very long so that it can hold our joints together. And so that we can use our muscles to do the work that we need to do. So skeletal muscle, by definition then, histologically, is going to be very, very long fibers. Whereas cardiac muscle doesn't have the luxury of having a long area to transverse. It just has a small area within the heart. So therefore, its tissue is not going to be long, rather it's going to be branched. So you're going to have a branching that's going to then be characteristic histologically of cardiac tissue. So if you see striated tissue, then you know it's either cardiac or skeletal. Then you go further and say, is it long fibers? Or is it going to be fibers that are going to be branched? If they're fibers that are branched, we know it's probably going to be cardiac. Now, non-histologically, we can look at skeletal as being voluntary. The other two, cardiac and smooth, are involuntary. If you see that special someone, can you say, be still my heart? Involuntary. If you eat Taco Bell at 2 in the morning, at 4 in the morning, can you say, I'm not going to the bathroom? Involuntary. So we're going to find smooth muscle in the intestines. Skeletal muscle, the histologically characteristic is going to be a multiple peripheral nuclei. So we're going to find the nuclei on the outside of the cell. Histologically, when we look at cardiac muscle, we're going to be seeing that we're going to have branched cells. We're also going to have a characteristic called intercalated discs. These intercalated discs are going to be responsible for allowing the muscle to be very electrical. They're going to be like little lines that we're going to be seeing between the muscle fibers. Some say intercalated, some say intercalculated, whatever. But intercalated is the way to say it. You're also going to be having one nuclei per cell, whereas, remember, the skeletal had multiple peripheral nuclei. We also have then smooth muscle. We mentioned it's going to be in the intestinal tract. The reason is because smooth muscle is non-striated. We don't expect it to maintain a contraction like we would, for instance, if we're holding on to something with our hand. Our skeletal muscle is very, very strong. But it's not very sustained. You can hold your hand together. You can make a fist for only so long, and then it gets fatigued. So with smooth muscle, it may not be as much of a contraction, but it's going to be more of a sustained contraction. So it can do such things as allow for the food to go through our digestive tract, rather than being extremely strong, but strong enough to push things along. So they're going to be non-striated. It's going to be a fusiform shape. So when we look at the cells, they're going to be thicker in the middle, thinner at either end. And they're going to have one central nuclei like our cardiac muscle does. Let's look at some membranes. Some membranes are going to be really what lines body cavities. Now we can have a mucous membrane which lines body cavities. We can have cutaneous membranes which may be lining the skin. We can have a serous or a synovial membrane. Now serous membranes are going to be producing like a fluid similar to water, a little thicker than water. Whereas synovial membranes are going to be producing a synovial fluid which is thicker. That's lubricating. It's more like the white of an uncooked egg. When we look at a serous membrane, we see it's going to be lining the in, internal cavities of the body. There's three kinds of these membranes. First of all, in the lungs, we're going to have the pleural membrane. Now, the pleural membrane is going to cover the lung. And what you're going to have is a cavity. The cavity is where the fluid's going to be. So you have the pleural, and you have a cavity within the pleural, called the pleural cavity. You also have the peritoneum. Now the peritoneum is going to also have a cavity within it, which is going to have serous fluid in it. And that's going to be inside of our abdomen. So we have the peritoneum inside of our abdomen. It's going to be covering our organ systems inside of our abdomen. We also have the pericardium. Pericardium is a serous membrane as well. The pericardium is going to have a cavity within it, and that cavity is going to be called the pericardial cavity with that fluid, that serous fluid. Now our synovial membrane, as we said, is going to be lubricating. So we're going to find this in our synovial joints, such as in our fingers, in our knee, in our shoulder. Any kind of joint that you think of that you can move a lot, you're going to have synovial fluid within that. So when we review the four tissue types, you'll see that they're all there. Let's look at some tissue terms. Hyperplasia and hypertrophy or hypertrophy. Hyperplasia is going to be an increase of tissue growth, increase of cell multiplication. Hypertrophy is going to be an enlargement of pre-existing cells. So if we go through an exercise regime of trying to lift weights, we'll see that our muscles will start to get bigger. This means that they're going to be hypertrophied. Did we get any more muscle? No. But what did happen was the muscle that was there got bigger. It hypertrophied. Similarly, but the opposite way, if a person had, like for instance, a cast on their leg, they would see that after the cast came off in 6 to 8 weeks, that they would have a less diameter in their muscles. So now we're looking at an atrophy. Atrophy would be the opposite of a hypertrophy. A without, hyper with. Trophy means energy. So the more energy you put into your muscles, the bigger they're going to get. But the less energy you put into your muscles, of course, the less they're going to get. They're going to shrink. Now we can look at neoplasia or neoplasm. A neoplasm would be a tumor. Now, tumors are neither good nor bad, necessarily. They can be good, they can be bad. But they can be benign or malignant. Benign is good, malignant is bad. So a new, you know, growth is going to be a tumor. So we can have a malignancy, which is going to be considered cancer, which is not good. But you can also have a benign situation, which may not be good either. A benign tumor within your brain, then it's going to push against the other nerves, causing some problems. So a brain tumor that's benign is still a serious situation because it can cause problems. You don't want pressure on nerves. The worst thing that nerves hate is pressure. So you can't have an increase of pressure from a tumor growing in there, even though it's benign. Similarly, too, suppose we have a tumor on our esophagus, but it's benign. It could push to the point where the person would not be able to swallow. And that would not be good. So sometimes benign tumors are indeed benign, and other times they're a cause for concern. Now the term necrosis, necro means death, osis means the process. It's the process of death. So necrosis will be a pathological death of tissue, for instance in gangrene, is due to insufficient blood supply. So we could have an insufficient blood supply, that tissue may die, and then of course then we have some problems. We could have like an insufficient blood supply to the toes, for instance. Let's say a person has a frostbite, and they may lose their toes because they became gangrenous. They became necrotic. We also have a gas gangrene, which is due to anaerobic bacterial infection. And this, of course, would also cause a necrosis. So if we do have this kind of tissue problem, we do have a tissue necrosis, for instance, how will the normal tissue heal? Well, it goes through a process of regeneration, where we replace the dead or damaged cells with original cells. Then we can go into a process of fibrosis, with a replacement of the damaged cells with scar tissues, such as collagen fibers. We can also get a keloid, which is a healing with excessive fibrosis. So you have a raised, shiny scar. This would be considered a hyperplasia. So when we are going to start with wound healing, first thing we need to do is stop something. What we need to stop is the blood flow. So we need to stop the blood flow before we start with the healing of the cut. So we stop the blood flow, and then we start to form a scab. That scab then is going to be eaten up by macrophages. They start to clean up the debris. So we first of all have a clot that stops the blood flow. We then have a scab formation. And then below the scab we have this healing process with the macrophages going in and actually cleaning up the debris. After a while, we expect the scab to fall off. When this happens, then we get this process of remodeling in the skin itself, for instance, if it was a wound to the skin. And that skin then will start to heal itself. Now, this process may take quite a while. It may take up to 2 years. Oftentimes, individuals will have operations, and they'll say, you know, it's been a year already, and, you know, I don't even feel any, you know, like, I still feel like a tingling at the site of the operation or whatever. Just tell the person, well, wait another year and it'll probably go away after you totally remodel. And they may say, well, how can I help my remodeling? And you'll say, well, it's important if you take certain vitamins, like for instance, A, B, C, D, E, and K. And they'll go, well, what's vitamin A good for? You'll say it's good for epithelial repair and antioxidants. You say, well, what's that going to help? That's going to help your skin heal. Go, oh, that's good. How can I get vitamin A? And you'll go, well, any vegetables that have color, carrots, for instance, squash, those kinds of things that have color, they have vitamin A in them. Vitamin B. You need vitamin B because that's important for cellular respiration, for ATP synthesis. You need that energy so you can heal. So they go, okay, so what kind of B vitamins are there? You'll go, riboflavin, niacin, thiamine, panthenic acid. There's a variety of B vitamins. I go, how do I get them? Whole grains, and also in brewer's yeast or baker's yeast. You go, you also need vitamin C. Vitamin C is important to make the collagen matrix. And they go, what's collagen? And you go, those are the thicker fibers. They help to support the connective tissue. You go, well, that's great. And they'll go, well, that's great. And then you'll go, yeah, it also helps to strengthen your blood vessels, which is also good for to get blood to the area so you can help it heal. So you'll say, okay, well, how do I get, they'll say, how do I get vitamin C? And you'll say, well, the citrus fruits are probably one of the best sources, but did you know that mushrooms are very high in vitamin C? And they'll go, mushrooms that grow in the dark are high in vitamin C? And you go, yeah, high in vitamin C. How about taking vitamin D, you'll say? And they'll say, I know about D, that helps with calcium. You go, yeah, that's true. It helps to mobilize calcium. It's also important, though, for your immune system and for a variety of other things. Vitamin D is very important to get. You should be getting at least 2,000 IUs a day, 1,000 to 2,000 of IUs a day. They recommend that for just about everybody, whether or not you get sun or you don't get sun. And then vitamin E is an antioxidant, which increases oxygen to the tissues. You go, well, how can I get vitamin D and how can I get vitamin E? You can get vitamin D, of course, from fortified foods. And you're going to get it, but you really should take it from a supplement as well. You can also get vitamin E from the whole grain, particularly from the wheat germ. And then vitamin K, where can I get that? And what's it good for? Vitamin K, we misspell it with a K because we're going to be calling it clotting. It's a clotting factor. It's important for clotting so that you don't bleed. How do you get that? In green things. Anything that's green has vitamin K in it.